Voices of VR podcast.
Hello, my name is Kent Bai, and welcome to the Voices of VR podcast. It's a podcast that looks at the structures and forms of immersive storytelling and the future of spatial computing. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/voicesofvr. So continuing my coverage from Venice Immersive 2025, today's episode is with a piece called The Great Orator. So this is a part of the competition that was at Venice Immersive, and it's sort of like a virtual reality and what's described as a bit of a VR diorama. So you have a little bit of a spatial exploration of this. It's a bit of a liminal space that has the environmental storytelling that's embedded into it, and that the creator Daniel Ernst talks about these, quote, perpetual environments around an emotional moment. And so the story is around a psychic who becomes so powerful that they kind of achieve this spiritual singularity where their consciousness has been uploaded into a computer, and there's all these followers that are coming into this place to also upload their consciousness into the computer. And so it's a bit of like exploring around this space of this big, massive mega church type of sci-fi speculative future where people are uploading their consciousness into the computer. And the main context is that it's a little bit of a point and click adventure into a cult, a spiritual cult, within the speculative future where this powerful psychic dies and becomes immortal by uploading their consciousness into a computer. They have lots of cult followers that also do this. And so there are themes of loss of individual identity to join the collective within this very specific set of beliefs that they could actually upload their consciousness into all of this. So the different center of gravity is that it's very much an earth element type of environmental storytelling exploration of this space. And so it's a VR diorama genre that is set into the distant future. So this is a piece that I think the director is calling the audience a visitor who visits rather than an audience who's watching or consuming. So there's very much this sense that you're visiting this spatial context. So very much the earth element of the environmental embodied context is emphasized here in the course of his work. Also, he's using these kind of postmodern architecture and liminality, and it's a world to be explored in a sort of point-and-click adventure sort of way. He liked to like pick one interaction and then take it to its logical extreme, which I think is what you're doing in terms of choosing where you want to go in this kind of waypoint locomotion, but also you're looking at object and interacting with them to learn about them. And then you're embodied as a bit of a ghostly aspirant ready to join the immortal spiritual cult. So you are embodied, but you don't necessarily have much of a character embodiment. You're just kind of more of already a ghost as you're going through this piece. Okay, so then there's this fire element is a little bit of the second center of gravity. So there's this bit of exploration. So it's very much of you are in this space, now what? Now you're going to wander, explore around, and chase your curiosity to learn more about what this world is based upon all the clues that you're getting. Then the third center of gravity is the air element. And so there's a lot of trying to kind of piece together this logic of what this world is and how it came about. And you get all these clues in terms of all these different objects that have metadata. You pick it up and you learn about them. But there's also quite a lot of artificial intelligence, generative AI components to these objects. And so there's lots of variants that are always changing and evolving. And it's never just one fixed thing, but that each person that visits is kind of seeing a different version of the different descriptions of the metadata. So there's quite a lot of generative AI that's being embedded into these objects and the different metadata. But he also like collaborates with a poet to be able to help construct these different stories of these objects and then have them be infinitely iterated on by generative AI. But it's also a bit of a speculative sci-fi world where the consciousness can be uploaded into the computers. And so there's these fundamental questions of like, how does that work? What are the rules of this world in terms of what has to be true and what has to be discovered technologically to even pull this off? And so there's a bit of, you know, learning more, a little bit more around that, but also just kind of exploring around the culture of this world as it exists. And so there's also a lot of this focus on these liminal spaces. So these intermediate spaces, the spaces that are in between. And so you kind of have a destination that you're going to. And so what about the space that is in the middle where you have to go through? And that's kind of the whole point of this piece is like the exploration of that liminality, that in-between space of this transitory context of you going from one place to another. So in terms of the water element and the story, it's not really narrative driven. In fact, the creator explicitly doesn't want to tell a story. He wants to treat the audience as a visitor who's visiting his place. And so he says, quote, "I don't like to tell you a story. I like for you to visit the world and the environments will tell a story." So there's stories to be discovered. So it's much more like ambient environmental storytelling. And there's also this kind of interesting part where AI is kind of like scouring what's happening in the current world right now, and that gets remixed into like these news announcements that are happening. And so there's a bit of a blending and blurring of, even though you're in this kind of speculative future moment, there's also these accounts of like news stories that I guess they're kind of cast in a bit of a historical narrative, or maybe they're recontextualized in terms of like putting it into the world. It's a little bit hard to discern exactly what's happening there, but there's this interface between these moments that are happening outside of the world and the wide world of the news that's happening, and those are being pulled in within the context of this story as well. And so it's kind of like this blending of those AI integrations. And so some of the different themes in Archetypal Character, it's looking at this expansion until a spiritual singularity happens with lots of what's truth, what's reality, dissolving identity into a bit of a collective identity by uploading your consciousness into a computer. I don't even know if that's even possible, even in the future, that will even be something that could be possible. But I think this science fiction world is kind of exploring these different themes. But this is a world to kind of like take those themes to the logical extreme. What would that look like if there was no checks and balances to these psychics? It's basically asking the question, what if nothing could stop the guru who believes in themselves? So we're becoming all that and more on today's episode of the Voices of VR podcast. So this interview with Daniel happened on Sunday, August 31st, 2025 at Venice Immersive in Venice, Italy. So with that, let's go ahead and dive right in.
My name is Daniel Ernst, and I've started working in VR in 2012 with the early DK1 kit. And I started an ongoing project called the Shoebox Diorama, which are smaller dioramas, sort of like a mosquito caught in ember. Like in each diorama, it has one singular interactive element that lets you experience a story instead of telling you a story. I also don't like to talk about players, viewers, but about visitors, since you visit these small little pocket worlds. And I'm always aware of that a visitor is somewhere in between reality and virtual reality, so I explore the liminal space in between. My current project, The Greater Raider, is selected in competition for Venice. And it's basically a lot of dioramas stringed together in a larger experience. Again, non-linear, time does not pass. Technically speaking, you are free to go wherever, whenever you want, except not in a festival setting where there's always a time slot.
Nice, and maybe you could give a bit more context as to your background and your journey into the space.
Yeah, so originally I started in the games industry. So in, I think, 2007, 2008, things are a bit murky a long time ago. I started working on games called Overlord, which is a very nice fantasy-style parody game. And I was a concept artist and a special effects artist. And I also did, you know, pick up some technical stuff in between. So I was the guy running around apartments, like talking to the designers, but also talking to the coders and, you know, being the in-between. And I always liked that position to be, you know, in between the arts and the technical side of things. And then in 2011, I created a game called Cargo Commander, with me and a former colleague of the company we worked. And then, you know, I did more things. I also started to pick up animation, and, you know, pick up more tasks. And, like, I was originally an artist, but then the DK1 was announced. And then I thought, crap, well, now I should learn to code as well, because how else can I express myself and freely experiment with the medium? So from 2012 onwards, you know, I do the whole process from the coding to the, you know, the art myself. Which is also why I like the format of a diorama. It's, you know, clear, defined rules. You can experiment with medium without, you know, going off into the stratosphere. And now I'm a bit of everything. And with each project I do, I like to work with people who can complement my work. So for this project, I work with Niels Egberts, who is an AI engineer at the moment working at Microsoft, but he is hobbying with my project. Poet Thomas Mühlmann, composer Armeno Alberts. So, you know, a whole wide range of people, basically. Yeah,
and in your artist video statement that you submitted to Venice, you shows some images of you flipping through like a sketchbook of a lot of the different images, and you're talking around like this provocation of these psychics, that you have this inspiration from the psychic that then transcends the consciousness. Maybe you could just give a bit of a backstory for the great orator and where it really began for you in terms of the inspiration to kind of build out these different liminal spaces that are strung together, but have like a bit of a loose narrative structure or architecture that gives it's kind of a mysterious liminal world that you're exploring and you're learning about it, but just curious to hear a little bit more around where that all began.
Yeah, so I always had a fascination or have a fascination for TV mediums and TV psychics. In this case, it's a TV medium. since the character in the work mediates between the real world and the virtual world. And like the original idea or the fascinations from a Dutch TV psychic called Jomanda, she would ask people in the early 90s to put a bottle of water in front of the television screen, and she would send her energy through the television screen into your bottle of water, so you got like a special energy water, you know. Which is, like, as a young person, that was like super cool. Like the whole story or the concept to send energy through television screens, amazing. But you know, those TV mediums or psychics, they usually have a set path where, you know, they grow, they expand their power. And then usually they end up with a scandal, like a tax evasion scandal or a sex scandal. Or, you know, in this case, there was unfortunately a famous Dutch actress who passed away because she didn't seek the treatment she needed for her cancer, which is very unfortunate. A very difficult legal case as well, because people choose to believe in, you know, those TV mediums or psychics, which is perfectly fine. I mean, there's also like a, you know, a good component of that where it gives, you know, guidance to people. But I pondered what would happen if like a scandal would not happen and they had the ability to grow and grow and grow until, you know, they became everything there is. What would a world look like if that would happen, like a spiritual singularity of some sorts? You know, then I started thinking about, okay, what should happen for that to, you know, be able to happen? And then I thought, okay, well, so the TV psychic or the medium should not fall for a scandal. So how can you achieve that? Well, then she should be an AI. She died at the top of her fame, and then she got, like, uploaded into an AI, and then all her followers could join her as well. You know, and from there on out, you know, I started expanding the world, you know, the logic of the world. You know, AI is an interesting component into the piece, which allows for like an infinite amount of possibilities as well. You know, and like nowadays also with like, if you look at the populistic politics where, you know, reality isn't really fixed anymore, it seems fluid. And there's no coincidence that AI has such a fast, rapid development, because AI makes reality, you know, malleable. You know, TV psychics, they also do this where they, you know, change the reality to fit their means, you know, and the followers will do the same. Yeah, so, and this is one giant metaphor for that, you know, rhetoric, that thought process of following and trying to find meaning in nonsensical things, or in infinity in this case. Yeah, long story.
Yeah, I think that helps set the context, because the narrative is, I'd say, a little bit occluded in the way that you have to kind of puzzle together. Like, there's a lot of clues, like everything you just said, you could sort of perhaps come out and be able to articulate a very clear narrative like you did, but I found it difficult to find like a strong narrative through line when I did it, because it felt like there was a character and I didn't quite understand the character. It was an AI, it was a voice that was speaking to me, but I didn't know the backstory. So it's helpful to hear some of the context or backstory of how it came about, because like you said, the primary experience of the diorama is that there's a single interaction, and so you are able to do one of two things. Actually, I think it's either you are able to locomote through a space and kind of explore the space, a spatial journey through these series of liminal environments that you've created that have like a fantastical, large, vast architectural feel to them, but also liminal feel to them. But also you could look at an object and then get a little bit of story about that object, and every time you do get information or context or like this mashup of poetry of these objects, then you get a different take each time. So there's kind of like a generative AI component there of large language model-esque description of an object and the meaning of the object. And so just curious to hear a little bit more around these two mechanics of both the locomotion as well as the pointing and getting more metadata information around the world that you're exploring.
Yeah, so that's always a challenge in my work, how to tell a story. Like, I don't like to tell a story, but you can experience a story. And it's difficult. Like, I don't like to talk, you know, about a story. It's a world. You know, a world has a history, and that history already happened. So then you visit that world, and by looking around, you can kind of puzzle together what happened there, but everybody will do it in a slightly different way. And it doesn't help that, you know, everything you point at and all the memories that are shared with you are, like, not fixed. Like, that's actually the through line of, like, she is nothing without you. Infinity is meaningless if there's not a person there to fix it into place. if you take off the headset and she's aware that you are wearing a headset and that you are you, then she will stop to exist. So it's important for me to, you know, have that interaction with the infinity to sort of explain that whole premise of, you know, what does infinity mean? When does it have meaning? Can you still speak of identity if the, you know, the memories are false? You know, and if you can, like, every identity of a human being is also strung together of false memories yourself. You know, there's some interesting thoughts there that I don't like to explicitly force down the throat of the visitor. But for me, like, just being there, you know, and sitting and listening to a scheduled oration in the background, that's like enough of an experience in itself. And that's often overlooked in VR, I think, where, you know, you're forced down a linear path. While VR, in my opinion, was always like the promise of simulated worlds. And this is my first, you know, foray into simulated worlds, especially when AI offers you, you know, the ability to, how do you say it? Like, create these perpetual spaces, which, you know, was always a big part of my dioramas as well. But now I can do it, like, with the content as well. I'm not sure if I answered the question at all.
No, that's really helpful to hear the differentiation between, like, the cinematic tradition of storytelling from linear film that is very explicitly telling a story versus, like, more world-building, or I guess you could call it environmental storytelling, where it's more of a center of gravity of the world, and then that there's a history and metadata of that world. And so this is a little bit of a exploration, and you're learning around the history of the world by interacting with these objects and getting these little clues that you have to puzzle together what this world is and what it all means.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, there was one more thing I wanted to say. It's like we also use the news in the orations. So when something happens, like, I don't know, a war somewhere, all the orations will also slightly change. The followers she describes are also based on the news. And it's very subtle, but that also helps with the whole feeling of having this world exist alongside ours, which, you know, again, is like a sort of a metaverse ID where, you know, all those spaces, they exist around you. And having this perpetual space sort of also fulfills that promise, in my opinion. And, you know, we use the AI and the news in different ways. There's a crystal ball. If you point at a crystal ball, she will use the news and does predictions about the future. You know, there's if you're in the parking lot, there's a scheduled oration that talks about different topics. And every 10 minutes, there's a news update where she talks about something in the news in your world, because she's aware of your world. And she talks about it as if it's your world. And how terrible it must be to bear all those sorrow. While in her world, everybody is, you know, freed from that. Yeah.
Yeah, and there's this real, I guess, dialectic between the infinite possibilities, what's possible versus the what's actual and what's grounded in reality. And it seems like that you're talking along an infinity and this kind of infinite possibility, and then grounding it down into these objects and these histories, and also mediated through a lot of large language model prompting. I'm just curious to hear a little bit around the architecture of the AI that you have in here, because it ended up being like, I would see the different objects and I would see like the different variations. And sometimes with large language models, it can kind of be very wordy and say a lot of stuff. And so, you know, there's the risk of getting into more of the negative aspects of, say, AI slop, where it just feels like a bunch of like words jumbled together. But it sounds like you were training it on some poetry. So just curious to hear around this kind of curation process, or this, you know, you can use large language models and just kind of have it unbounded and it can be trained on all sorts of different data from the internet. But there's also either training it on specific data or prompt engineering to contain it in a way that you have a little bit more authorial control over what's being said. So I'm just curious how you were trying to wrangle in the large language models within the piece.
I think wrangling is the correct word for it. It felt like doing rodeo, like I felt like a rodeo clown. Like the development of the AI, like, was also a long time in the making. Like, originally we started in 2020 and GPT was kind of new back then. And there was no off-the-shelf solution for it. So I worked together with a Leiden university, and we managed to put the GPT-2 model on the Quest headset while also allowing you to walk around the world. But the output was not as good. There was a lot of repetition. You had to really force everything, like with very specific prompting. Like, it took a lot of time to get that to work. But we did. but like then we progress, and you know, AI progress, and then you could do more coherent things. And because of that, also, you know, sort of the story or the way how you would interact with those objects would also kind of change. And I got better results if I collaborated with the poet Thomas Mohlmann than if I would just, you know, do some prompt wrangling. So we use different ways of doing that. I mean, it feels like we can still get like even better results out of this system, but it's so new. So we have like Thomas wrote like lots of prompts himself. And based on that, we get like an output. We could do retraining, but we didn't have like a lot of time to set that up. Also, there's not, you know, a memory. Well, there's some memory in the experience, but not like, you know, no reinforcement learning or whatever. We didn't have time for that. But I think it's still believable enough what we have achieved. So yeah, I used the poet to write the prompts, and that definitely helped with the output. And we also feed in the poems of certain topics into, you know, for example, the objects, which, you know, are mostly memories that are being shared. And like the shared consciousness, like the space, the mainframe space with all the tiny screens. If you point at the screens, you'll see like stock videos of the people playing, and you hear all their anxieties. Like we also got like a nice list from Thomas where he wrote down like all these beautiful anxieties and things people struggled with. And there was a big difference, like if we did that without Thomas Mohlmann's work or with Thomas Mohlmann's work. Yeah, I still want to experiment more with it because I think we can get better results. But also, like, I don't like to use AI to make Thomas obsolete. You know, we use AI in collaboration with Thomas to do something we're not, you know, it's impossible to do in a different way. And often AI is used to make people obsolete or to maximize profits. And I didn't want to do that. I want to find a way how it can be like a functional part of this world and how you interact with the objects. And, you know, so yeah, I hope he achieved that.
How did you get the variation? Because each time you click on an object, it's slightly different. So are you resending new prompts to like ChatGPT, or are you doing it locally, or how do you have different seeds? How do you get some different variation each time you click on the object?
Yeah, like here I'm showing the desktop version, so that works slightly different than the Quest version. But I wrote this scripting language with which I can write orations. So there's a lot of that's written by Thomas, like that is needed to have like a narrative through line. That's always fixed. But then when you activate an object and you get like all the variations of the object's memories, then I also feed in like random tags. And those tags are, for example, a life face, because she, you know, recollects memories from, you know, her whole life. I get like life struggles and more tags that are replaced with a random input. So that's how the output is changed slightly each time you activate an object. Like it's subtle, but it works. Yeah.
And you said that you were drawing in the news. So how are you pulling in the news and then translating that into like announcements?
I've written a simple scraper, news scraper, that reels in some news, and then that gets interpreted by the LLM, and then yeah, you get the output. And then we use that in different ways, because that's also, it's really cool, but it's also kind of scary because you can do so much and you want to do everything, but you can. So I had to be very deliberate on how I would use it and where. And again, I think I can, you know, do even more with it. But perhaps that will be done in another project. Who knows?
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could describe some of the different scenes and environments, these kind of liminal spaces, because you start off in the psychic home. You can point and click to kind of move in locomote around. You can go outside of that, and the home is within a church-like space that then has rafters and a cloud wall, and then you can also go into the waiting room and then outside into like an infinite parking lot. You can go and visit and get stories with people whose cars are parked there. So yeah, just curious to hear you explain the many connected liminal spaces that you have in this world.
Yeah, like in each space the orations work a bit differently. So you start out in the preserved house, which is the former house of the TV medium that is your guide and the journey. And she recollects memories from her life. but she doesn't know which memories are hers or if she even existed at all. And you don't know that either, but that's, you know, besides the point. And that's the house she died in. So there's a slight eeriness where it is hinted that she is not around anymore. And then there's the shared consciousness, which is like a mainframe. And in the mainframe, there's the house of the Great Orator. And it's hooked up to like a bunch of cables that run all throughout the world. And the shared consciousness is where all the souls of the followers are stored. And it's visualized like a bunch of small screens that stretch out into infinity down a large shaft. And if you look up, you see like a fake TV panels of clouds where the clouds move by. And, you know, because that's, well, it is the cloud where all the people are stored. That's what, hence the clouds. And that's a nice joke. I love that so much. And, you know, the followers are also a metaphor for the data set that's used for the AI, which also consists of like lots of memories of like thousands and thousands of followers. And then when you leave the shared consciousness, you go into this empty hall, which is like an empty factory space or, you know, like a industrial area compound, super empty. But there's always like a constant sound. You hear the wind being sucked in. Because the great hall that you're in, it's basically like one giant ventilation shaft to cool all the screens of the followers in the center of it. So you hear this wind come in through all the vents on the exterior walls. And when you go out one of those ventilation shafts, you get like a nice overview of the infinite parking lot. And the infinite parking lot is where the followers abandoned all their cars when they got like stepped into the shared consciousness. And I never explain how that happens, and it doesn't really matter in my opinion. But that's like sort of a graveyard, basically, because those are the remnants of the followers. But each car you see in that infinite parking lot is a story. So that kind of visualizes the infinity stretching out in front of you and how it's actually a pretty cold and lonely place. While the preserved house is like very warm, and it feels almost like a heart with like the red cables being veins and whatnot. So, and then you go into the blank space, and the blank space is sort of like a crematorium space where, you know, the loved ones gather and say goodbye, which, you know, is in a sense, a crematorium is also like a liminal space, a transient space. And here you get an explanation that she needs you to exist. Because without you, she isn't everything and therefore nothing at all. So if you take off your headset, she stops to exist. And she also tells you that it's quite a burden not being able to join the shared consciousness because she needs you. And that's your burden. You have to stay in the world for her to exist. And then you're free to wander around that empty parking lot, which feels desolate and empty. And there's this scheduled oration that's like a perpetual scheduled oration that blares over the speakers in that parking lot, and it feels cold and it feels empty. And at that point I build in some quiet moments, because then you can just hear the wind blow in between the scheduled oration, and it feels even more empty. You can only achieve that if you set up like all the noise in the beginning of it and all the mumbling of all the shared consciousness. There you're basically abandoned. So yeah, that's the last space, and that's also the space where you probably will end in a festival setting, of course, because this piece would work differently if you don't have like a 40-minute time limit, because then you can also go back, you can return. Now, I also had to take into account in the story that it takes 40 minutes in total, and I have to make sure the visitor gets from point A to point B. So you could argue that it's linear in a way, but technically it's not, and you're free to go wherever you want. But yeah, that's the challenge. And it also changed the narrative to have like a fixed thing. Yeah,
I enjoyed being able to explore around the space. And, you know, it was hard for me to know exactly what I was looking at. And your description and everything is very helpful just to kind of understand the intent behind the design. But as I was in the world, I was just marveling at the spectacle of the liminality of the spaces, but not really understanding the full context of what exactly it is that I was looking at. But as you're describing all of that, the thing that comes to mind is that there's this, I guess, metaphoric reflection of the power of AI to kind of like a matrix-like thing where it subsumes people and creates them as batteries or uploads their consciousness. It's sort of a, you know, transhumanist or anti-humanist way of dehumanizing of our humanity, the way that technology can, you know, in some ways you could say the smartphone is creating these portals of escape and addiction that allows the populace to be brainwashed in different ways. It seems like that there could be some metaphors for the ways that you're creating a spatial architecture of people getting their consciousness uploaded into this guru spiritual quest. But just curious to hear any reflections on the metaphoric reflection of the role of technology in society today.
Oh yeah, that's they say that VR is an embodied medium, but like I always feel it's a disembodied medium. You know, I always feel a strong disconnect that I know that I'm not completely there. And I like to explore that in-between space of like knowing that you're in the real world, but also visiting this space somewhere in between. Lynch, for example, does that in his movies as well, where he breaks the fourth wall in order to create this like very haunting atmosphere where you're not sure what's real anymore. So, yeah, that's also why I, made sure that you're being reminded that only your mind is there. And it's similar, like all those followers stored on the screens that are also like just their minds are there. So that hopefully makes you think about like what does your own identity mean, and you know, what does it mean for your mind to go somewhere else? What does it say about your body? Yeah. Does that answer?
No. yeah, for sure. And it seems like that also a big point is like moving away from a way of looking at things in this fixed static way and looking at it this ever-evolving, changing process. And I've been really drawn to the work of Alfred North Whitehead and process philosophy, which is trying to move away from like substance metaphysics of seeing kind of the fixed nature, even our language or subject predicate nature of our language trains our mind to think about things in this kind of fixed object way. But yeah, I'm just curious to hear a little bit more around this origin point for why you wanted to really emphasize this kind of changing nature rather than something that might be fixed.
Yeah, like the world should also not be approached as like a fixed thing, like I've seen it once and that's that. Like the experience is set up that you have to return, you know, because you don't want to disappoint the great orator. You want her to exist, so you have to return. And I feel that like I like the idea of having these perpetual worlds. And you can't have a perpetual world if there's an ending. So that's why I like the open-ended structure of it. And also, you know, VR allows you to feel specific, like a very abstract concept such as infinity. I mean, I can talk about it, probably you should like have a scientist do that, but like having create a world that embodies that feeling of infinity is very powerful. And I don't know another medium that can do it than VR. So I like to explore these concepts and emotions and physical sensations that you couldn't otherwise achieve. And having like this infinite parking lot, knowing that each car is like a story, that sort of allows you also to see AI in a different way, but also see the emptiness of it. You know, it can make you think in a way that's not as abstract. You know, if you look at the stars and you try to perceive infinity, your mind will stop quite fast because you can't conceive, you know, beyond like the bunch of stars you can see. Well, in VR, you can be, or in the great radar, I hope at least, is that you, you know, can allow your mind to think beyond the point where your mind says, oh, well, I fucked this shit, I can't handle this. Yeah.
Yeah, and hearing a lot of this return of themes of infinity, the indeterminate nature, the ever-folding processes that are changing and evolving, and I think when I come to a place like Venice Immersive, I see a wide range of different projects, and projects that are coming from a cinematic tradition try to collapse those infinite possibilities into a singular story. And sometimes the specificity of a story could land into a human experience that I can really identify with. And so there's, I guess, value of the collapsing of that possibilities into something that's, let's say, a little bit more authored in terms of the experience. And so there's a way that when I see a world that's so much leaning upon the AI and the sort of infinite possibilities, but also this like more loose narrative structure around it, that it, yes, it gives me the sense of infinity, but also in that
feels like a sea that I'm getting lost in, where I don't quite know what the point is at the same time. So I feel like there's a tension there between like the narrative satisfaction of knowing what it's saying versus the ambiguity of not quite knowing what this is trying to say. And as I sit down with you and hear the intention, I can see the intention that you're saying, but there's like a gap between my experience of the piece and the intention that I'm trying to negotiate, understand the VR as a communication medium and trying to close those gaps rather than widening those gaps. So I don't know if you know what I'm getting at, just trying to, if you have any reflections on that.
Yeah, like, first of all, I do not make entertainment, I make art. And I think that's a big difference. You know, if I would have made entertainment, then having a narrative construct of infinity would suffice. Like HAL 9000, for example, that's a perfect example of an AI story structure. While we created a world that actually functions as one, like, infinity is not a narrative construct, it's actually there for you to visit. So that's a different way how I go about thinking about these worlds that I create. And yeah, people will miss things, and that's fine, and people will feel lost, and that's by design. You should feel lost in the parking lot because you are there. Like, you are very lost in infinity. It's a cold and lonely place. I've spent 5 years in there making this project. Yeah, don't try this at home, kids. It's fine if people miss things, you know, and it's fine if people start to talk about things. It's also fine if people feel that there's something there, but they can't quite express it, like, in words. Like, I'm not a writer, you know. I can't do proper writing, or, you know, Thomas can. Luckily, he helped me out. But I can visualize things and make you experience and feel things. That's my forte. Yeah, so, like, it's perfectly fine if you don't understand everything in that world. I mean, if you go to, a park and you walk through the park, do you completely understand the park to enjoy your time there? I don't think so. You know, perhaps on your fifth visit, then it starts to click. You see more, you know, you hear more, you click at the object that has that tiny bit of information that clicks with you. Perhaps you don't, and that's also fine. Perhaps you run into somebody who did click on that object. You know, it's, yeah, I don't like to think in a linear way. Yeah, it's not entertainment, it's art.
Yeah, and I guess a part of my experience was this sense of open world exploration that I think can be difficult, and something that has a very fixed linear structure. And part of my experience was this sense of adventure, trying to discover different worlds. And somehow I went directly from the room into the waiting room, or this kind of like memorial place, and then the place that before you got in the parking lot, and then somehow got back inside. And then if you just look at it, so yeah, it went directly from the first room into the waiting room. Then I got up into like the house again somehow, and then outside, and then yeah, it was sort of even more of a non-linear path than what you were describing. Because yeah,
that's not by design. Then something went wrong. Like, that's also the problem with a project like this. Like, if it was a linear project, it was much easier to debug. But like now, if you, for example, stand in one room and then click on a very specific point in another room, then perhaps the system trips and then you get an issue. You know, in game design, that's very common. You know, it's a reason why they spend a long time debugging everything, playtesting and whatnot. Like, I'm unfortunately not a big studio. You know, I get help from, a couple of people. Unfortunately that happened. Sorry, Kent.
I think I saw all the rooms. It was just like, felt like I was able to explore. As you're describing each of the rooms, I think I like hit each of them. I guess, you know, what's some of your takeaways from working with AI in terms of what's your take on it, where we're at now as a society, and what role AI may play either in the creative process or moving forward?
I like to see AI as a, you know, interesting step forward to simulated worlds. But I think it should always be a tool used to do things you can't otherwise do with, you know, human beings or artists. You know, culture is something you share amongst humans. If you introduce something that can do it for you by a prompt, that's not culture. Then you negate a very important part of society. You know, and we're here at like a pretty important movie festival. You know, with a large industry with different departments, you know, you got people who make props, you got like actors, you got actors in front of the camera, you got actors in the back behind those actors. And you know, there's a whole industry, and I think that's more important than trying to maximize your profits with AI by doing everything with AI. You know, there's an industry that should be fostered and not destroyed because, you know, it's cheaper. And there's this thing I'm scared of, and that's like, you know, AI can give you everything you want. Like, it's very difficult to give somebody what they don't know they want. And that's, you know, what makes life interesting, I think. People get lazy if they get everything they want and bored very fast. And also, like, if you are able to get all the entertainment, and I'm talking 10 years in the future, perhaps 5 years in the future, perhaps even faster, who knows. But like, the taste of people in the media they consume will also change towards AI. And it's easy for people to say, oh yeah, it's AI slop, but people won't enjoy it as much as like a good movie made by people. But you saw with TikTok what it does to attention span of people, where they get hooked on this like dopamine rush of, you know, nonsensical entertainment. You know, the same can happen on a much larger scale if you can just prompt away and get the media, exactly the media you want. You know, people's tastes will also change, and then they won't have like the, you know, my project is already like 40 minutes long, which is like perhaps more than most people can take. You know, and if somebody can get like a big dopamine rush by typing in a prompt, getting exactly what they want, then, you know, watching a movie that's 3.5 hours long by an obscure director, that probably will be more difficult. Yeah, that's what I'm afraid of. Should I end with something more optimistic? Because, like, I mean, it can also do like lots of cool stuff that you couldn't otherwise do. And I hope we illustrated that in the Great Orator. Yeah.
Are there other ways that you used AI in this project?
Well, it's the text to speech and then the text generation. Like, we deliberately did not do speech to text because it will open up like a Pandora's box of issues and problems. And I didn't want to get into that. No. And like, there is also an ethical concern, of course. I like all data sets to be open source, so you know where, you know, the stuff comes from. And it's very difficult to do it like 100% ethically sourced. I mean, it's now the Wild West of capitalism where, you know, it doesn't really matter what they use for data sets as long as the big tech companies profit off it. So I draw the line at generating images if that's based on the work of illustrators. You know, and that's still, that is kind of hypocritical because, you know, data sets also consist like writings of, you know, writers. But that's why I use Thomas as well. So we didn't replace Thomas, we expanded his work. But I do hope that like the data sets will get open source so you can use it for good instead of like profiting off all the artists who did not consent for giving their content.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of my biggest complaints in terms of like how they're stepping off on this real colonial empire foot where it's the seizing of the data without consent and then the mass automation and consolidation of wealth and power. It just feels like it's kind of like starting off at a place where it can only go even more downhill from there. So I get a little hesitant in terms of AI as an automating technology and what's being automated and who benefits and where's the power being consolidated within the context of that. And so as you're working with AI models, like, are you using OpenAI, Llama? Like, what kind of models are you using in order to do this work?
Yeah, like for the Quest version, like everything running on Quest, we use Pythia, which is, I think, the most open source, ethically sourced models you can use. For desktop, we use Llama. You know, I had lots of conversations with universities in Holland, and they also use Llama. They say it's the best mix between ethically sound and what you get out of it.
Which they did use a lot of like pirated textbooks and stuff like that. So I don't know how ethically sourced it actually is.
No, exactly. That's my point. Yeah, I mean, it's very difficult to you know, do everything 100% ethically in this field. Like in Europe, for example, they are working on data sets, like European data sets that are ethically sourced, but it will take time. So in the meantime, this is the best I can get. Yeah, now I feel dirty.
I think it's part of the larger discussion around AI in terms of like, there seemed to be like an AI abolitionist approach where it's just like I'm not using it. And there's also, you know, as a journalist and oral historian, concern around ethics. There's a way that I'm listening to artists and seeing what they're doing, but also, you know, trying to, when I can, push back and say, like, hey, what are we doing? And are we going in a direction that we want to go? And I feel like we're at this crossroads right now where there's a lot of excitement for the potential and possibility, but also, like, we're, you know, 30 to 40 years into the internet, and America's devolving into fascism and authoritarian democratic backsliding. So it's like, okay, we've seen where this not paying attention to the effects of some of these larger information ecospheres and the combination of technology with all dimensions of culture and politics, we kind of see where that's headed already. And now we're accelerating that in some sense with AI. So I've certainly got a lot of concerns around it in general, where it's at now and where it might be heading.
Yeah, I completely agree. I mean, there's now some weird rampant capitalism going on, even more than before, where, you know, like the whole development of OpenAI and AI at Google and whatnot, like they had ethical departments who would put a stop to that. Then OpenAI said, well, fuck that ethical department. I'll just like release it into the wild. Like the run fast, break things mentality, which I don't like at all. Like in the EU, we have a very strong... you know, not strong enough in my opinion, but still strong, better than the US, no offense, to, you know, try and stop the power of tech corporations taken over completely. But it seems now, especially with like the political situation in the US, that it, you know, it's difficult to push back on that because there are repercussions, and with a war at our doorstep, it's difficult to push back. And, you know, the government now in power in the US, they, you know, they have AI and they try to push it hard. It's like one of the economic points of growth in the country, which I find disheartening because I don't think like we can do much against AI. Like the governments can do that. We can't. They can say, okay, well, you know, listen, the data sets should be open sourced, you know, and then you get the whole discussion of free market and how much, you know, governments should influence that. Like, I think, you know, society should also have a say in technology that might possibly disrupt those societies. And we don't get that choice, unfortunately. And now even more so, you know, when they, you know, the guardrails seems to be, you know, removed completely. Yeah, that's scary. Yeah.
So if we go back to the great orator, like, do you feel like that you're synthesizing all these ethical dilemmas or aspects? And it feels like in some ways a potential dystopic consolidation of that power and some unity consciousness and people kind of subsuming themselves and losing their humanity and uploading their consciousness, having no sovereignty. It's sort of repeating a lot of those kind of themes. So yeah, just wondering if you have any reflections on how your piece is kind of reflecting a potential future.
Oh, yeah.
or an existing future.
Yeah, like it's definitely like it was never meant to reflect you know, the current situation as much, but you know, as you kind of materialized like it, like when you know, the current president got into power, like in around 2018 it was, or
2016, and then 2024. Yeah,
there you go. Yeah, and you, like lots of the rhetoric that normally was used by TV psychics mediums is now used by politicians as well, where it's not necessarily about facts, but it's about a feeling. And that's a dangerous thing because feelings can change. They're never fixed. They're always changing, changing with what's going on in the world, changing with, you know, what gets the most popularity for the populists. So that's very much, you know, part of the experience as well, you know. And the lesson learned, if there is a clear lesson, which I don't like my work to have, but like if you want to take a lesson out of it, it's like with populists, you know, they give you the feeling that you need them, but in fact they need you. And like the great orator can also not exist without you, but she makes you out for like the most important person there, and like she's also the most important thing. You share that. You know, there's a feeling of community there, be it like a sort of a like a toxic codependency. And I feel it's sort of the same way with populists nowadays as well, where they give you the illusion you need them. And, you know, they got their tricks to make you want to keep believing in them, where in most cases they want you to feel, you know, not safe, unhappy, unwanted by society. Like in The Great Orator, I chose to do the opposite and make you feel very wanted. You're very important. You know, life in her world is relaxed. You don't have to worry about a thing. So it's sort of like the opposite there, but like, yeah, the lesson learned is that you don't need them as much as they want you to believe.
Beautiful. And I guess as we start to wrap up, I'd love to hear what you think the ultimate potential of virtual reality and this type of immersive storytelling or immersive world exploration might be, and what it might be able to enable.
Yeah, well, that's a good question, and a very difficult question to answer. So I can only answer it from my perspective about what I'd like to do in the future, and that is to explore these simulated worlds more. I think AI allows us to create these simulated worlds, and I want to see what's possible. Like, how far can you go with the characters? You know, yeah, simulated worlds.
Okay, so anything else that's left unsaid that you'd like to say to the broader immersive community? Any final thoughts?
What I would like to see is more open-ended, non-linear works. You know, I would like to see more of those. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Danny, thanks so much for joining me here on the podcast, and really enjoyed the discussion that we had about the Great Orator. And, you know, also the VR Chat World Gallery, I think, has a lot more of those kind of open worlds. If you haven't seen Dr. Morrow's The Ritual, you should definitely check that out. But yeah, just this kind of combination of world design with liminality, but also kind of infused with this. There's a story that's there. It's not necessarily the strongest thing that I'm taking away in terms of putting all the puzzle pieces together. I think, you know, as I talk to you and hear about it, it's like a process of discovery in the process of going through the world, but also in this conversation. And also in a way reflecting this current reality that we have right now. So kind of this allegory, metaphor, reflecting the potential dangers of the technology, while at the same time embracing and using the technology in a way that you're trying to find your own pockets of ethical or moral kind of rationalization, justification to create something that at the end of the day is creating a piece of art that people can explore around and kind of discover for themselves. So anyway, just really enjoyed the piece and the conversation, and lots to think about for sure. So thanks again for joining me here today on the podcast.
Thank you so much, Ken.
Thanks so much for tuning into this Venice Immersive 2025 coverage. And hopefully you found some use in some of this documentation of these experiences that are very ephemeral. And some of these show at these festivals and they don't really go out widely beyond this a lot of times. I mean, maybe they are, but you may not be in a place that it's easy for you to see them. And so it's a real privilege to be able to see all these experiences, but also to be able to sit down with these creators and have a really deep, in-depth conversation in a way that there are not a lot of other opportunities to really dig into at this level. And so really appreciate all the time from all the creators to be able to have these conversations, but also for you to take the time to listen to them. And also it's been a challenge of trying to find a way of speaking about these experiences in an abstract, theoretical way, or at least in a way that I can ground it and allow you to put yourself into the experiences to kind of imagine some of these different things that they're doing, how I'm experiencing it, but also the different types of design decisions that the creator is making. So if you find this useful and want to support this type of effort of both documenting the history of immersive storytelling, but also to support this kind of wildly ambitious independent journalism project that is very much driven by support by listeners like yourself. So please do consider becoming a member of the Patreon at patreon.com/voicesofvr. Thanks for listening.